Windy City Queer Cast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
We're talking mega gay.
Ooh, I like that.
I'm Amy Matheny.
This program is brought to you in part by American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow.
Listening to the Windy City Queercast, show number 486. I'm Amy Matheny, and happy week to all of you. I hope you are excited about the fall season being upon us. There are so many wonderful things going on. Much to look forward to in arts and entertainment, many fantastic concerts and plays and art exhibits and movies and just so much as we start looking toward fall previews for all kinds of things. And you'll hear about many wonderful events and opportunities and arts organizations and groups to be a part of what they're doing this upcoming season, so to speak. But we're going to take one more show to look back. We're going to look back to the big AIDS conference, the 19th International AIDS Conference, with our good friend Jim Pickett of the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. He is the Director of Prevention, Advocacy, and Gay Men's Health. And we've talked to him for many years through the Life Lube program and also just to kind of be our touchstone on what's going on in the HIV/AIDS community around the world. And this conference was held this summer, just a month and a half ago. And Jim is going to sit down and talk to us about what some of the biggest topics are with HIV/AIDS right now. It's a very important show, and it's good to know how far our community has come in 30 years in its work and advocacy on people living with HIV/AIDS. Of course, this began as what was called, you know, the gay men's disease, and now it has become a global epidemic that we all in our consciousness and citizenship are trying to be informed, educated, and continue to work and gain resources, insight, and funding for the fight against HIV and AIDS. Pretty much, I assume most everyone listening to this knows someone who is living with HIV, living with AIDS, or has lost someone to the AIDS virus. So really great show with our very good friend Jim Pickett. Happy to have him on the show with us. And also we're going to tell you what's going on in the GLBT news. Maybe Chick-fil-A is turning a bit of a corner. Who knows? This all on the heels of the big Democratic National Convention, the slam dunk by the Democrats, as most people are saying, even Republican strategists are saying that it was an amazingly run convention. I know many heads have been into the politics of the United States as we head into this election season. So lots of other GLBT news, though, and entertainment news, and what's going on in the theater scene. So let's get started.
Vancouver is home to Western Canada's largest LGBT population, and now you can enter for your chance to win the Lights, Camera, Attraction prize package to Vancouver, British Columbia. a safe and welcoming destination for diehard shoppers, avid outdoor thrill seekers, nightlife aficionados, and dedicated food lovers, Vancouver is a world-class city offering something for everyone. From sports pubs to drag shows, leather bars to dance clubs, lounges and restaurants, Vancouver's got it all. Plus, Vancouver Pride celebrations and the Vancouver Queer Film Festival in July and August, and Whistler's Winter Pride in February. Tourism Vancouver is pleased to offer you and a guest the chance to win a trip to Vancouver in 2013. For a chance to win the Lights, Camera, Attraction sweepstakes, visit tourismvancouver.com/lights by November 30th, 2012 to enter. That's tourismvancouver.com/lights.
I'm Kirk Williamson.
I'm Amy Matheny.
And this is The Week in News. Jamal Edwards' two-year tenure as CEO of Chicago's Howard Brown Health Center has come to an end. The announcement came at the end of a period that had been clouded with doubts, even as it began with much promise, after initial news that the agency was in severe financial crisis. Howard Brown held a press conference earlier this year to declare that it now had a $1.2 million surplus. However, such notable achievements have come at the cost of cutting health care for some staff at the center's Brown Elephant locations, most of whom have been turned into part-time employees in order to save on their health care costs. At the same time, Edwards' salary in 2011 was $265,000.
Chick-fil-A President Dan Cathy met with college and university leaders in Atlanta recently to discuss the company's future involvement with LGBT issues. After a summer filled with controversy when Cathy announced his position against marriage equality, he and the COO are now attempting to repair his image with college leaders. Chick-fil-A is aggressively trying to expand onto college campuses, but has met resistance at schools such as UCLA and New York University.
Colorado is experiencing history as two gay candidates are battling for a spot in the state Senate. In the state's 31st district, which includes parts of Denver, openly gay Republican Michael Carr is opposing incumbent Democrat Pat Stedman. Carr was put on the ticket after the original candidate dropped out and said the party approached him to run.
Lesbian Illinois State Rep Deb Mell is recovering from surgery 3 months after announcing that she had stage 1 invasive breast cancer. On August 10th, Mell, age 44, had a bilateral mastectomy with immediate reconstruction and is awaiting a second stage reconstructive procedure.
Paul Bebeau, the Arizona sheriff who announced he was gay after a former lover accused him of abusing his power, defeated three Republican challengers in his bid for re-election.
GLAAD has announced that the actor-activist Wilson Cruz has joined the organization as its strategic giving officer. Cruz, known for his work on TV shows My So-Called Life and Noah's Ark, as well as films like He's Just Not That Into You, will be part of GLAAD's development team, helping to fund the organization's work amplifying stories from the LGBT community that build support for equality.
Lesbian actress slash activist Meredith Baxter will serve as the keynote speaker at Dallas's 31st annual Black Tie Dinner, November 3rd at the Sheraton Dallas Hotel. The sold-out event is the largest one-night LGBT Black Tie fundraiser in the nation. Comedian slash actress Caroline Ray will MC the event. In addition, Chaz Bono will receive the Elizabeth Birch Equality Award, and JCPenney will be the recipient of the Black Tie Dinner Media Award.
In Maryland, Christian Ariel Romero, age 20, has been charged with attempted murder and theft after stabbing a gender-variant person after the two engaged in a sex act. Considering Romero admitted attacking the victim because of gender identity or expression, he could face federal hate crimes charges under the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act.
In Boston, U.S. District Judge Mark Wolf ordered the Massachusetts Department of Corrections to provide sex change surgery to transgender inmate Michelle Kosolek, born Robert Kosolek, who's serving life in prison for murder. In so ruling, Wolf, who is reportedly the first federal judge to make such a decision, said that to not provide the surgical option violated Kosolek's Eighth Amendment right to adequate treatment. Kosolek, who identifies as female, has received hormone treatment and lives in an all-male prison.
In California, four U.S. Marines were arrested after allegedly assaulting a gay man, and the attack is being investigated as a possible hate crime. The victim, a film student, blacked out from being beaten outside the Silver Fox Bar in Long Beach, which he went to with his boyfriend. He was briefly hospitalized.
Pia Sundage, the lesbian who coached the United States women's soccer team to a gold medal at the Summer Olympics, has stepped down to return to her native Sweden. Sundage has signed a four-year contract to coach the Swedish national team.
In Michigan, transgender male Seth Knopp has joined the university football team at Grosse Pointe South High School. Knopp, a running back, said he wanted to join the team last year but was afraid to come out. However, this year he was told the school's athletic policy permits co-ed sports teams. Knopp said most people have been supportive, even in his conservative town of 5,000.
In world news, in Brazil, a gay man was granted 4 months of paid parental leave, the same amount of time that biological mothers are granted in Brazil, after he and his partner adopted a child. Typically, Brazilian fathers get only 5 paid days off from work when their children are born.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel has rejected calls to give LGBT couples the same tax breaks heterosexual married couples enjoy. Merkel's coalition government is divided over this issue, and factions have developed over extending adoption rights to gay and lesbian couples.
Poland's ruling center-right party is planning to introduce a law of registered civil partnerships that will include same-sex couples. The bill includes a range of benefits currently available to only married heterosexual couples, including inheritance, pension funds, notary, and medical rights. However, there is strong opposition within and outside the party.
In Turkey, a gay teenager's father and uncle reportedly murdered him in a southeastern province. The boy, who has been named as Ra, is said to be 17, and his family had known about his sexuality. Ra had been living with a friend's family because he had allegedly been exposed to violence by his own family because of his sexual orientation.
In entertainment news, the cast of the upcoming Logo series RuPaul's All-Stars has been named. The 12 contestants include Pandora Box, Raven, Manila Luzon, Mimi I'm First, Chanel, Chad Michaels, and Latrice Royale, among others. The 6-episode series will premiere October 22nd.
Oscar-winning songwriter Hal David has died of complications from a stroke at the age of 91. Along with singer-songwriting partner Burt Bacharach, David won an Oscar for Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, Grammys, and Tonys for the songs from the Broadway musical Promises, Promises. They were also responsible for the hits such as That's What Friends Are For and Close to You.
Julian Michaels has rejoined NBC's The Biggest Loser. Michaels, who has 2 children with partner Heidi Rhodes, will be a part of the show's 14th season, which will feature the series' first ever teenage contestants.
Ellen DeGeneres received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame on September 4th. The 10th season of Ellen's Emmy-winning talk show returns September 10th.
The 2012 Gay Days at Disneyland is October 5th through the 7th in Anaheim, California. Festivities include musical duo Carmen, an intimate conversation with Florence Henderson, and a sneak peek at Logo's new series, RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars. See GayDaysAnaheim.com for more.
After 2 decades of programs, In the Life Media is airing the final episode of the Emmy-nominated series In the Life this December.
Lori Lindsay, an alternate on the United States women's soccer team during the Summer Olympics, has come out of the closet. Lindsay's mom is also a lesbian and has been with her partner for 25 years.
Barbara Streisand's Release Me, a collection of 11 previously unreleased songs showcasing her career from 1963 to the present, will be out on vinyl September 25th and the CD on October 9th. Highlights include Didn't We, written by Jimmy Webb and recorded in 1970 for an unreleased album project titled The Singer, and Willow Weep For Me, an unreleased track recorded in 1967 for Simply Streisand.
And stars such as Rihanna, Drake, One Direction, and Taylor Swift were at the MTV Video Music Awards September 6th, but many feel that out-singer Frank Ocean stole the show. Ocean sang a stripped-down version of Thinking About You, a song off his CD, Channel Orange, while seated by a fake campfire and wearing his trademark bandana. And that's the Week in News, brought to you by Windy City Times.
Hi there, this is Deb Pierce reminding you it's okay. Go ahead. You're not alone. Post a comment.
Don't miss the most ambitious and spectacular burlesque show ever to hit Chicago. Superstars of Burlesque. A cast of over 25 performers grace the stage at Chicago's historic Music Box Theater on Friday, September 21st. Enjoy a night of glitz, glamour, and nearly nude debauchery in this one-night-only event created by Michelle L'Amour. Tickets are $25. VIP admission is $50 and includes two drink tickets and priority seating. And buying two VIP tickets gets you a bottle of champagne to share. Superstars of Burlesque is one night only, Friday, September 21st at the Music Box Theater in Chicago. For tickets and a sneaky peek, visit superstarsofburlesque.com.
Culture Club. Culture Club. Culture Club. Theater.
Music.
Dance.
Art.
Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Weird.
Innovative.
Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of September 10th, 2012, you are in Chicago's Culture Club. Xanadu, which the New York Times called Heaven on Wheels, is now playing at Drury Lane Theater. The New Yorker raved that the production is ridiculously brilliant, lavish, and sublime. Broadway's Gina Milo stars. Dinner show packages available and parking is free. For tickets to Xanadu, visit DruryLaneOakbrook.com.
The Auditorium Theater presents Michael Feinstein and Jeff Lindbergh's Chicago Jazz Orchestra, performing classics from the Great American Songbook, September 29th at 7:30. For tickets to Michael Feinstein, visit Ticketmaster.com or call 1-800-982-ARTS. That's 1-800-982-ARTS.
And for more Culture Club, visit WindyCityTimes.com. Hi, this is Brian Batt of AMC's Mad Men, and you're listening to the Windy City Queercast.
If I ever caught you, your minor indiscretion, I would never let you go. I have made a promise to try for forever. Is the color the way to go? No, we all need so much more. Sense of humor is all we're left playing for. I would fight for. I would fight.
Our friend Jim Pickett of the AIDS Foundation of Chicago's Director of Prevention, Advocacy, and Gay Men's Health has just returned from last month's 19th International AIDS Conference held this year in Washington, D.C. And he's here on the Queercast again to update us on the biggest topics on HIV and AIDS right now, happening right now and being revealed right now. Hey, Jim, how are you?
Good, Amy. Thanks.
So you get to travel the globe with your work around HIV AIDS. Was it good to be in the States and the good U.S. of A. for a change?
It's nice to not have to deal with enormous time changes and, you know, traveling thousands of miles. But, you know, once you kind of get to your place and you start work, it could be anywhere. So being in D.C. could have been just like being anywhere else. It was really intense, a lot of work. And I saw my hotel room for a few hours every night, you know, when I was trying to sleep. Otherwise, I was running around the convention center and the conference meeting rooms like a crazy person.
Yeah. Well, it's 19 years. How many people attend this conference and who's there? Who are the attendees?
Well, this year, the numbers range from what I've heard, but I heard, you know, the top number was about 25,000 people. Mm-hmm. So they were saying this was the most highly attended International AIDS Conference ever. They're always in the 20,000 range, though. So pretty huge. And it's really, you know, the entire globe comes. So it includes people from Northern and Southern hemispheres. It includes scientists and researchers and doctors and officials. It also includes advocates and community members, people living with HIV, folks, you know, pharmaceutical companies. It's a complete circus. Mm-hmm. It's just everybody comes. And it's, I think it basically any category of someone who works in the HIV/AIDS field, they're represented there and then some.
And is the purpose of a conference like this to really just help connect and mobilize people, present papers? I mean, what is the purpose? How was this founded?
Yeah, so this conference, it used to be, in the earlier days of this conference, it used to be about breaking new science and breaking new research. And some science is occasionally broken at this conference, but science is now, new science and new findings tend to be broken at smaller conferences that are more specific to research or specific mm-hmm. topic area. Mm-hmm. This one, in the past it has broken research, this year it didn't, but it really is about kind of connecting huge, enormous global community working on these issues, all different types of players, getting them into the same rooms. There's lots of presentations, lots of workshops, lots of networking. And, you know, as you often say about these conferences, that, you know, you learn a lot of things in a session looking at PowerPoints, but a lot of the real action happens in hallways and meetings with folks you run into, and you plot and strategize and come up with new ideas. And I know that's certainly been the case for me. I've gained a lot. I've learned a lot, you know, just from watching scientists present data on this or that. But really exciting things happen in the more casual settings where you run into people, you brainstorm, and next thing you know, you have a new project and you have a potential funder and, you know, so it's a great place just to connect with the huge global community that's doing this work on so many levels. And if you're doing global work, you don't get to just run into your colleagues from Uganda or from Thailand just by, you know, accident. So at a place like this, actually seeing people you work with throughout the year, mostly on the phone and email, seeing them in person, being able to sit down and have face-to-face time is really incredibly valuable.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in an effective way, as you said, to bring lots of different partners together to make something effective happen for all of you who are doing this in your own little corners. Where are we today? I mean, this is a, you know, we've just had this past year where it's been the 30th anniversary of the discovery of the virus that we come to know as HIV, AIDS, and with this conference, 20 years after the mobilization of an international conference, forums in which these are discussed. Is it a hopeful place that we are today? How would you just kind of describe where we are 30 years later?
Well, I think the top line message is it's hopeful and optimistic. I think, I mean, to work in this field, I have to be hopeful and optimistic. If I was a cynical person and pessimistic, I'd have no business doing this work.
Right.
But that said, it's, you know, there's also challenges. So we have challenging economic times. We have challenging data that shows we're doing poorly with gay men and other men who have sex with men across the globe in every setting. Gay men are getting the shaft, not in a good way. And so it's a mixed bag. But I think we're at a place now where new tools to prevent HIV are a reality. So just days before the International AIDS Conference in Washington, D.C. kicked off, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, approved an HIV drug for the use as prevention. So they approved a drug called Truvada, which is normally used to treat with people living with HIV. It's now been approved for use as a preventative. So you, as an HIV negative person, you take a Truvada tablet every day, and this prevents HIV quite well if you are adherent to the regimen. Mm. So now we haven't had new tools in years. You know, we've had condoms, and condoms are great if you use them. But if you can't use them or don't want to use them, they don't work. So this is extremely exciting to have something new in our, you know, quote unquote prevention toolbox.
Well, yeah, and I want to go back just a hair and then come back into talking about PrEP. The story for gay men at this conference is that the community is not the community is still at too high of a risk. There is not we're not gaining ground there on prevention and the fight against HIV/AIDS. Is that what you're saying around the globe?
Yes. Okay. In most places in the globe, we're losing. There's a few exceptions, but in the United States, among people living, you know, the HIV epidemic is growing among one population, and that's among gay men, and that's particularly among young gay black men. It's not growing in any other population. The numbers are going down. Okay. And globally, we also see this to be the case. I mean, there's a number that varies. This is a median number, kind of a middle-of-the-road number. But in basically anywhere in the globe, or if you look at the globe as a whole, gay men and other men who have sex with men are 19 times as likely to be living with HIV compared to the general population. So that's a striking number. And in some scenarios, that number is higher. And in some scenarios, that number is lower. Mm-hmm. But it's bad. And we see throughout the globe that resources aren't matching the epidemic. You know, there's 80 countries that criminalize LGBT people. You wonder how well they're doing on HIV prevention and care and treatment for gay men. Not so good,
right,
in most cases. If you're in a country where you're illegal just for being, you can bet that services are either non-existent or very scarce or very hard to access, because accessing them would mean coming, you know, identifying yourself and putting you in very serious harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
That said, you know, I have colleagues in challenging countries doing amazing work and rising above this stuff and sticking to it, even in the face of really daunting situations. But the overall story is we're doing a bad job. And there a journal called The Lancet, which is a reputable medical journal, did an entire issue that was released especially at this conference focusing on the global epidemic among gay men and MSM, men who have sex with men. They took an entire issue and they lay out all the data, all the stats, all the things that are being done, all the things that aren't being done, and what needs to change in every type of setting you can imagine. So if people are interested, they can Google The Lancet and MSM and HIV or something like that, and it'll come up. It's all open access,
mm-hmm.
and it's really quite stunning. So, you know, you and your listeners, no one should take my word for it. If you think I'm full of hot air, and I probably am at sometimes,
uh-huh.
But in this case, I'm, you know, don't trust me. Go to this journal, and you'll see for yourself just how badly we are doing with this population on a global level.
Well, and is that a shift? Because I feel like the story was trending for a number of years that the rising cases were amongst African-American women. And so now we've gone back to the story being that gay men, now specifically black gay men, is where the numbers are on the rise.
Well, actually, gay men in our country, if we're looking at the domestic crisis in the United States, gay men have always borne the largest brunt of the epidemic.
Okay.
We make up just a small percentage of the population, and we've always been 50, 60% of the epidemic.
Okay.
Despite the fact that we're 2 to 4% of the population or something like that. Where I think it gets confusing and tricky is that among women, African, you know, the risk among women in general, the risk is much higher if you're an African-American woman. And those numbers have been rising among women, but the overall numbers are decreasing. So overall heterosexual transmissions have been on the decline in the United States. Overall,
uh-huh.
transmissions due to injection drug use have been on the decline. The only population where the incline is happening are gay men. And interestingly and sadly, it's among young gay black men. And for white men, it's men my age in their 40s. So there's a big blip among white gay men in their 40s who are becoming infected. And then among black men, it's younger. And I, you know, it pretty much bears out for younger Latino men, too, are at higher risk than others. And what's also really fascinating about that, at least in the case of the young gay black men, and we've seen data on this now for several years, is young gay black men don't have higher risk factors than their other race mm-hmm. sort of compatriots. They actually have less risky sex, take less drugs, use condoms more compared to white men. Mm-hmm. But there's just so much HIV in the population, mm-hmm. Due to a number of structural factors. A lot of HIV in population, people who are not on in treatment, who don't know their status, and because of lack of access to healthcare, issues around poverty, mm-hmm. issues around employment, issues around housing insecurity, all of those huge structural issues that are not directly HIV prevention, in fact, are. If you are unstably housed and hungry mm-hmm. and don't have a job,
right.
you are at much higher risk for HIV infection, especially if you're in a population where there's a lot of HIV, such as young gay black men.
Right.
So what's tricky about all this is we've often focused on individual behaviors and said, well, individuals, you know, need to change your behavior, you reduce your risk. Well, in the case of young gay black men, it's more than that. It's certainly individual behaviors is important, but the other piece is are these huge structural barriers that prevent access to healthcare and all the things I just mentioned mm-hmm. that put them at significant risk.
Right.
Even though they're having less risky behavior, you know,
right,
it's kind of,
right.
it's not intuitive until you kind of, can you see that bigger picture? And the bigger picture is just fraught with problems.
Well, and I appreciate you just clarifying that because, you know, it is tied and can be tethered to the conversations on PrEP drugs that we talked about in our last podcast with you. And now what has come out with the FDA just approving the use for prevention, you know, right before the conference began. Just uh-huh. for fundamentally, what is the idea behind PrEP drugs and in general? And I know that this has been, we talked about some of the findings and the controversy on our last show, but just what are PrEP drugs? What is their intention again?
So there's one drug that's been approved, although other drugs are being studied.
Yes.
So the drug that was approved is a Gilead drug called Truvada. It's actually a combination of two different drugs. And the idea is, it's sort of like when you go to an area in the world where there's malaria mm-hmm. and you take medication before you go there to prevent you from, if you get bit by a mosquito, you won't get malaria.
Yep.
So you take it before you're there, you take it while you're there, and you take it after.
Right.
And PrEP works in a similar way. You take it regularly. And you take this, you know, ideally in conjunction with other safe sex practices. But if we're being really real here, there's plenty of people who don't want to or can't use condoms. So this provides protection for people where there currently is none.
Right.
If you're not using a condom, no protection. So this is about giving people an option and a choice that might be more acceptable to them. It's also what's interesting and nice about PrEP is that it's not connected to the sex act.
Mm-hmm.
It's not dependent on you being ready at the time of sex to do something, some kind of preventative behavior like putting on a condom or
right.
what have you. If you just take your pill every morning, you're basically, you know, in pretty good shape. Your risk of contracting HIV, if you take it consistently and correctly, is lowered by 90%. Which is pretty amazing, you know, consistently and correctly being key words here.
Yeah.
So it's really just about providing options for people who can't or don't want to use condoms consistently and correctly. And we really don't think that PrEP is something that people are going to do. You know, people get very excited and think, oh, my God, you're going to put an 18-year-old on Truvada and they're going to take Truvada until they're 70. And we're going to put every gay man on drugs. No, that's not the case. This is a niche intervention. This is a niche thing. Not everyone will need it. It's not appropriate for everyone. And people's prevention needs and sexual behaviors change over time. So you might need PrEP for a couple years of your life, or you might need it here and you might need it there, but you don't, you know, no one is seeing this as being a lifelong intervention.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing this as a, you know, this might help you during a period of time in your life where you can't negotiate condoms, where you're not using condoms for whatever reason. I don't care what the reason is, you know?
Right.
But no one's seeing it as you're now going to get on this expensive drug and we're going to keep you on it until we say goodbye and send you off to the next life. That's no one's thinking that.
So how can people get access to this, though? I would imagine that a huge majority of the people who probably need this drug, and you just said it was expensive, you know, can't afford this drug.
Right.
So, you know, isn't this kind of like a, this is kind of a boutique drug in the effect that it's going to be for, I guess, you know, primarily men probably, but I guess women can take it too. I don't know. You know, that want to have sex unprotected or think they may have sex unprotected. And so that is who is going to be able to have access to this drug right now. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Well, so yes, cost and access is a big issue. And anyone advocating for this, I think we're all very much adamant about this not being only available to, you know, in a boutique way. I said niche, but I didn't say boutique. We don't want this to be a boutique drug that's only available to people who have extraordinary means and can pay for it out of pocket or have really great insurance that covers it. Insurance mm-hmm. is already covering it for a number of people. Mm-hmm. We are, you know, working hard to, you know, let's hope we're able to implement the Affordable Care Act.
Yep.
And in the Affordable Care Act, there will be, you know, there will be prevention services that are automatically covered through that. PrEP could be one of those.
Right.
Insurance companies could cover it. Medicaid could cover it. Programs that are prevention programs that are run by cities and states could cover it. And finally, Gilead itself has promised to have a compassionate access program mm-hmm. for Truvada as PrEP. So mm-hmm. like drug companies have for people who don't have means and fall through the social safety net, they can access the drugs through these programs. Mm-hmm. Gilead is going to be providing the drug for free to people who meet the requirements, you know, whatever level of poverty you have to be at or mm-hmm. the lack of means that you have to demonstrate. You can have access to the drug and to ongoing testing for free. So there's a number of things that are out there. Now, putting the puzzle together, that's where we're at now, and that's what we talked a lot about at the conference. Mm-hmm. We have this compelling data. Truvada works. And by the way, Truvada has been approved by the FDA for gay men and other men who have sex with men, for heterosexual serodiscordant couples, so for heterosexual couples where one person is positive and the other person is negative.
Uh-huh.
And it's also been approved for, quote, other high-risk individuals. So it's a rather broad uh-huh. indication. It'll be up to clinicians and providers to start help, you know, figuring out, like, who is the best candidate for this. But it's not just for gay men.
Right.
It kind of originally started that way because the first trial that showed Truvada worked was among gay men, but then we had trials that showed it worked among heterosexuals, and it worked among heterosexual couples
right.
who were serodiscordant. So anyhow, all of those people are potential, you know, there's groups in those populations that are potential recipients for this intervention. And now, you know, everyone's trying to figure out through demonstration projects, ongoing research and open label studies to see what is the best way to deliver this drug, to provide the wraparound services that are necessary, to target the people who are at the highest risk.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we get it to, you know, a 20-year-old gay black guy who, you know, is just getting out of school maybe, or doesn't have a great job, doesn't have great insurance, if he has insurance at all,
mm-hmm.
Certainly can't pay for this out of his pockets.
Yep.
So how do we, yet he needs this. So how do we make that happen? And those are the questions and those are the things we're figuring out right now.
Well, and it's interesting, right? Because I mean, I don't mean this to be a crude analogy at all, but it'd be so great with a drug like this at this time in the world, which is a very different time than like perhaps the advent of AZT, that this would be like a Tom's shoes kind of thing. You know, if you bought a pill, they would give a pill, you know, and that we would hold a company like this accountable to giving back, you know, to the community for the longevity of this drug, because the, you know, the wider spread this drug is for them. I mean, not only on a public health level, but also on a branding level or an efficacy level, that would be a good thing, you know, for a company like that to do. And I'm hoping that their feet will be held to the fire by people like you and other people within, you know, the, the community who work in the HIV/AIDS community to make them, you know, accountable to that kind of giving back, because I think that's going to be significant. We have to move on, or we're going to have to do a whole other show, which we could probably do. But I do just want to know really quickly, if you can just real quickly tell me about your rectal microbicide research, and how is that going?
Well, so, you know, I head up a group called the International Rectal Microbicide Advocates, which is based at AFC, but is a global network. Mm-hmm. And so we do advocacy, and we push for more research and development activities. And we're actually in an exciting time. The field is moving forward. The trials are expanding for the first time. We're going to have a phase two trial, which just means we're getting closer to the day when we can have a trial that actually sees if something works or not. Mm-hmm. There's a long process in drug development where you have to do a number of trials that determine safety. But, you know, for the first this year, later this year and early next year, a big phase two trial is opening in the U.S. and in sites outside of the U.S., mm-hmm. which is new. And so that's exciting. So the field is moving forward. The National Institutes of Health are still very supportive of rectal microbicides, and so that's great. They always have been. In terms of vaginal microbicides, we actually could be just a few years away from having something become available. A trial has shown that a vaginal microbicide could work. Another trial showed the same microbicide didn't work, so there's actually a third trial basically underway now to be a tiebreaker, to see, does it work or not. And so that's a phase three efficacy trial, and we should have data on that in a few years. We could have a vaginal microbicide in a few years. A rectal wow. microbicide is probably a decade away. But the good news is we're moving forward. So yeah. as with science, you have to be patient. You have to have a long view, but we're taking a big step this year. Moving the field forward into these phase two trials. So that's exciting.
That is very exciting. And I know we will continue to follow you along in that research and advocacy work that you're doing. Yeah. We love having you on the show. I just heard that you got to go, you were invited to the White House, and you're such a great representative of this community and the work being done in this community. How was that? And how are you feeling about our president on the topic of HIV and AIDS in a presidential election year?
So it was, when I first got the invite from the White House as an email, I thought it was spam. I was afraid to open it. I thought it was going to infect my computer and, you know, destroy my life.
Yes.
And I guess other people thought that too. It's not often that you get something that says it's from the White House, but it was real. And I went, and it was a very nice, you know, event. There was a couple hundred people probably there, so it wasn't like a quiet sit-down chat with Barack.
Right.
But he came, you know, he was there, and he made remarks, and just a very moving moment for me. I was, we had pushed our way up front, so we were really close so we could get a handshake. Mm-hmm. I was with a colleague of mine from Nigeria who is now living in the UK, but he... you know, he's from Nigeria. He's one of the first, if not the first, Nigerian to come out publicly as gay. He did it on a TV show there and became quite a phenomenon, but which also ended up forcing him to leave the country because it was no longer safe for him to be there. So he's this huge gay rights advocate for Africans. He does a lot of work in HIV/AIDS. And he was standing up right up front with me, mm-hmm. when Obama came out. And, you know, I was like, I was really hot and tired, and I was just sort of like, okay, this is cool. But I wasn't overwhelmed by the moment. But my friend, when, you know, here is the president of the United States talking about black gay men and the mm-hmm. needs of black gay men. And my friend just became like overcome. And he was like crying. And so when Obama went down the rope line to shake people's hands, my friend like almost completely fell out. He like fell forward. He tried trying to kiss Obama's hand. I don't know if he got his lips on there, but he came awfully close. And he was just completely overcome with emotion.
Wow.
And it freaked out everyone standing around us. All these people were like freaked out. Like, what is this guy doing? And Obama was very cool. He was like, hey, dude, it's all right. You know, chill out. He was just very cool as a cucumber. all these other people around us were flipping their wigs and started to yell at him. And I said, listen, you don't know who this guy is. Like, he's just really overcome right now. He's not going to hurt anybody. But here, you know, his story is, and I just gave a quick kernel of it to basically ask them to stop yelling at him, you know? Mm-hmm. If he was a security threat, I can tell you the Secret Service would have been on him in 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. And Obama was a cool cucumber. But that moment just really reminded me of, like, how important leadership is. And when people around the world hear the U.S. president and the U.S. government saying LGBT rights are critical and important, saying that we need to focus on Black gay men where the epidemic is really hard hit, saying those things, it's a very powerful. It's powerful for me, too, but I was sort of removed from that. He helped me kind of come back and connect to, wow, this is really pretty cool. Yeah. And Obama has been a great leader, I think, in terms of the HIV/AIDS response. There's a lot of criticisms about him and criticisms about him reducing funding for some of the global funding streams. Mm-hmm. I think it's very, very complicated. I will say, you know, it wasn't until Obama's administration that our country had a national HIV/AIDS strategy that was for the U.S. It was his administration that did it. It is his administration that put the focus on Black gay men. Gay men were never prioritized before. Mm-hmm. They were ignored in so many ways. Its proof is in how the funding flowed for many years. Funding did not most impacted populations. So like any presidency, it's a mixed bag and nothing is perfect. But from my perspective, I think he's done a great job on all kinds of things. And, you know, speaking as a human being and not as a representative of any organization, I support him.
Yeah. Well, and it's like you said, it's just what a revolutionary thing for that man, you know, to be in the room with the president of the United States alone and also the president of the United States who happened to be an African-American man, you know.
Totally. Can you imagine? I mean,
two gay black men.
Yeah, he's like 20. He's a 20-something-year-old kid. He's still really young.
Yeah.
And he's already had this phenomenal life.
Yeah.
You know, being this advocate so out, having to leave home, having to leave his roots and his family, live in the U.K.
Yep. What a moment.
And then
what
to have moment. That interaction, I mean, that just, even telling you gave me goosebumps because it really slapped me back to reality, like how meaningful the whole situation was.
Absolutely. Well, it is so meaningful to have you a part of our friends and allies of the Queercast. We're so grateful to have you come on, you know, often and talk to us about what is going on in this area. And if you would like more on the conference and all of these topics and more, because we could have talked for another 30 minutes, we have it all connected in our show notes, but you can go to aidschicago.org/AIDS2012 for information on the 19th International Conference. Jim, thanks so much. We look forward to having you on again real soon. I know we will.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Amy.
Got something to say? Call us today, 312-21-BE-GAY. Well, everybody, I hope you have a great, great week. We are deep into the month of September, and it's obvious this week. Hard to hit a date like September 11th and not think back on to where we all were on that date over a decade ago now. It does not seem like it's been that long, but it has been. And just remembering those that were lost and those who worked so hard on those days and weeks and months following the September 11th tragedies. So in remembrance, I sign off and say have a wonderful week, everyone. America. Thanks for listening to another Windy City Queercast. Special thanks to our Queercast family, Kirk Williamson, newscaster, and Di Sturkey, production editor. I'm Amy Matheny, your host. Please comment on our shows at WindyCityQueercast.com and iTunes. The next Queercast is only days away, so don't miss it. Subscribe today. Windy City Queercast, queer and now. From above, from the mountains to the prairies, to